I'm Kim Carson. I'm so happy you found my podcast, Conversations with Kim. Whether I'm having a conversation with a celebrity, an author, history maker, record breaker, or the average everyday person, we all have a story to tell. And maybe that story just might change another person's life. We can learn so much from each other. Let us discover some of life's most valuable lessons with today's guest on Conversations with Kim. Today, my conversation is with Dr. Randall Bell. He's the author of the book, Rich Habits, Rich Life, The Four Cornerstones of All Great Pursuits. Thank you so much for talking to me today, Dr. Bell.
Hey, Kim, it's great to be on your show.
Well, first of all, tell me, what inspired you to write this book, and who would you say the book is for?
Well, I'll tell you what inspired me. 20 years ago this year, I was at Chernobyl. Of course, that was the world's biggest nuclear accident in history. And I was there to do some work, some consulting work, and I saw these military guards. They had uniforms on and machine guns, and they broke out sandwiches and vodka and offered me some for lunch. And I thought, you know what? I don't think it's an accident that, or coincidence that the world's biggest nuclear disaster occurred in a culture where this is okay to have a machine gun literally in one hand and a bottle of vodka in another. And so since then, I've been correlating various habits with various outcomes in terms of good or bad outcomes. I kind of sum it up as poor habits cause disasters and rich habits cause success.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating book. I've never really thought about things quite in the terms that you talk about. But why do some people achieve and remain successful, or at least it seems like that on the outside, and others fail?
Well, that's a great question, Kim, because I'll tell you, when you think about it, life is 90% habits. You know, you have your sleep habits and you have your morning rituals. And then you have your driving habits and study habits and communication and then eating habits. And so we got to really look at our habits. People that tend to be very successful really pay some specific attention to what they're doing. And they do certain things day to day that are tiny, but they add up to very big things. And it really boils down to taking a good look at our daily habits and are they really laying the foundation we really want to have in our life or our business?
Yeah, and I'm kind of curious because when I look around, you know, I just lost like a massive amount of weight, like 115 pounds, right?
And, wow, and good for you.
Yeah, yeah. But when I was 115 pounds heavier, I kind of felt like I was almost in like a food fog, like things weren't quite as sharp. And when I look around, I see that. I see people that are just kind of almost going through the motions of life. So I'm curious, does health play into success in your book?
Well, absolutely. And there are four sets of habits: me, we, do, be. Me habits are improving our level of wisdom. We habits are building our relationships. Do habits are things like you just talked about, Kim, you know, taking care of our health and taking care of our money. And the be habits are building our futures, like goal setting and time management, those types of habits. So they're like four legs on a chair. If one of them's out of balance, it's not a comfortable ride. You got to have all four in place to really have a solid foundation.
Yeah, and you also talk about something in your book called Dive, Survive, Thrive. And it was the first thing first time I ever heard post-traumatic thriving. Talk about that for a bit.
Yeah, I came up with that term because I study disasters. In fact, right now I'm on the East Coast, you know, looking at a big environmental disaster affecting thousands of people. And I got to tell you that when a crisis hits, there's only three options. You can take a dive and never recover to your baseline. You can survive and work your way back to the baseline. That's admirable. But thrivers are the people that kind of bounce back bigger and better than they were before. And for 25 years, I had the privilege of being with those people, the people that really tend to bounce back and have enormous amounts of vitality and resilience, and really take lemons and make lemonade. I know that sounds cliche, but that's really the mindset that has been fascinating to me as I've studied all these cases over the years.
Yeah, I mean, and there's a certain kind of person that can have that post-traumatic thriving. What are some of their characteristics?
Well, the first thing is they're not flash in the pan. You know, so much of the success gurus out there have sugar-coated nonsense about success, and it really doesn't work. The post-traumatic thrivers is a term I came up for people that they tend to have a just an intelligent, paced day-to-day effort. They realize they're not going to dig out of this situation all at once. Like, you didn't lose over 100 pounds, you know, in a day.
Right.
It's a day-to-day, sensible effort. And if you fall off your horse, you get back on and you just keep going. That's the mindset. It doesn't have as much sex appeal as some notion of firewalking and these notions of success gurus. But this is what really works when it comes to authentic success.
Now, let me ask you about the digital world, because you have a chapter in here and you talk about digital drugs. Do those help our success, or do they kind of come up against us?
It's a great question, Kim, because it's kind of a two-edged sword. You know, I love technology. You love technology. We all love technology. But you can take it too far. You know, I've been to restaurants where I'll snap a picture of an entire family sitting around a table. They should be having a conversation, and they're all, you know, texting. You know, their heads are somewhere else.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's going too far, where we're just simply addicted. I have a 15-year-old son. He's your typical California surfer kid. Great kid. Smart, good grades. I love the kid. But, you know, he gets into these video games and things where, you know, just it's just like pulling him off of heroin.
Once
in a while, you got to take a break.
Yeah, because, I mean, I don't know that there's any studies on it, but I think it changes us internally. I think that when your brain is just locked into a piece of technology, somehow we're losing skills that got us to this place where we are as humans, where we've evolved a bit with communication, especially be able to sit across the table from somebody and carry on a conversation. I think it messes with your mind, you know.
It really does. What it does when you play these video games or this Pokemon thing that's going on right now, it stimulates the brain. It actually secretes endorphins that are kind of counterfeit. You know, when you go on a run or go on a walk, you get a natural high. Those are very healthy because they're not addictive, they can be addictive, but they're addictive in a good way.
Right.
But when you play these video games, you're getting these counterfeit secretions of the brain that can be really quite damaging. There actually are studies on that whole topic.
And you're losing hours and hours and hours of life. Like there's nothing to show for it. You know what I mean?
Oh, exactly. And time is life. And if you're wasting your time, you're wasting your life. And I'm all for some entertainment. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
I'm not like down on digital technology.
Right.
But you got to do it in balance. Like me, we do be. You got to build relationships. You got to read. You got to do all the things in balance.
Yeah, and you even talk about reading. How reading's a big barometer to success.
Reading is huge for the me cornerstone because it builds intellect, and there's very much statistical correlations between readers and education and intelligence, income. Everything goes up when you're an avid reader.
Yeah, when I first started the book, I was wondering if you were going to touch on this, and then about, I don't know, it seems like it was two-thirds in maybe, where you talked about connecting with a higher power. What does that look like, or what does that mean to you?
Well, I'm very respectful of different, you know, belief systems. Some people are religious, some people are not. Spirituality doesn't mean necessarily religion. For some people, religion's a great thing, and I respect that, and for some people, it doesn't work for them, and I respect that. But in terms of being all about ourselves and think that there's nothing greater out there than ourselves, I don't see that. And I once had lunch with Penn and Teller. Penn is the tall guy. He's a very devout atheist.
Yeah.
And he really got annoyed with me because I said, you know, I told him, I don't have enough faith to be an atheist. It takes an enormous amount of faith to be an atheist, if you think about it.
Yeah.
Because the level of arrogance is that you can't scientifically prove there is no God until you go throughout the entire universe and verify that scientifically.
Right, right.
And so short of that, it's all faith. So I respect how people have different systems, but I think having a belief system and a faith in something is really beneficial.
Yeah, and you know, your book is filled with all these great stories, and I just think we can always learn so much from each other through our life experiences. And I particularly enjoyed one of the early stories that you told about Danny and the push-ups and where he came from and the challenge you gave him and the homelessness. Talk about that for me, if you could.
Well, sure. I live in Laguna Beach, California, and we're very fortunate, and I mean that word, fortunate, to have two homeless shelters where the community rallies around and helps people that are having a tough time. You know, it's a lot of alcohol abuse and a lot of prescription drug abuse, frankly, that gets people into these places. And Danny was in my class, and I was telling him my stories and me, we, do, be, and so on and so forth. And he got really excited, and he came back. He called me Dr. Bell. I said, don't do that, Danny. Just call me Randy. And he says, Dr. Bell, I've got these. He had this list on a yellow pad of 12, 15 new huge habits. I said, Danny, just pick one. And he said, okay, I'm going to do 50 push-ups in a. And I said, Danny, you know, I've seen these post-traumatic thrivers everywhere from Chernobyl to Hiroshima. That's not how they do it. Your commitment, Danny, is to just do one push-up a day. And he said, well, I can do that. And he did. He did one push-up a day, but it turned into 10, 20, and it did turn into 50. Then Danny started going down to the library and checking out books and reading them. Danny started going to the beach to meditate. Danny started putting out his resume. Danny got a job. He got back on his feet. I can't tell you the thrill it is when people that are homeless get back on their feet, get jobs and productive, reconnected with their family. It's the best high out there.
Oh, yeah, because they never even could have dreamt that it could have happened. I mean, you get to that place where you're so beaten down, and then to see somebody kind of come alive again, really. And
yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, those are the kind of stories that are in the book that I love. Now, what's the three-line effect that you talk about?
Well, there was a sociological study where they would bring a bunch of kids in the classroom, and there would be a kid outside in the hall. They would artificially delay him for some reason. And then the kid would come in, and they would, the professor would say, is line A equal to these three lines? And the whole class would vote in unison on the wrong answer. Wow. And the real question was there peer pressure on the one kid that had come in to yield to what the rest of the class said? It was a complex study. I don't know how well I explained it, but it was all about peer pressure and aligning yourself with a group, even though the group was wrong. And in three quarters of the cases, 75% of the time, people would go along with the group, even though the group was blatantly wrong. It's really a chapter and a discussion about standing for something. And if you know something's wrong, you know, have the guts to say, hey, you know, I'm not going to go along with this, rather than just yielding to the peer pressure
that,
to come along.
That's really true. But to counter that, because I live that way, but to counter that, you have to be prepared for the possibility of a sacrifice. Like for me, it cost me my job doing the right thing and you know, reporting it. It ended up costing me my job. Was I willing to pay it? Yes, I thought about it before I did it, but you have to be knowing that something may not end up the way that you think it would.
You're absolutely right. You know, I exposed a charity fraud once, and I had to literally move my family from the fallout. It's called the whistleblower effect. It's well documented. But when you have some ethics and you stand up for something and say, you know, I'm sorry, but when you steal money from battered women, I'm
right.
not going to go along with that.
Right, right.
You know, it's doing the right thing, but there is fallout. But that's the price you pay to just be honest and ethical.
Yeah, I figure, well, you know, at least I can look at myself in the mirror in the morning. But, you know, here, I loved it. You talked about the danger in bad habits. And so what kind of bad habits are you talking about when it comes to sabotaging one's success? I loved where you even said making your bed or not making your bed can make a difference.
It really does. Making your bed puts your head into a productive mindset, and you're also statistically 207% more likely to become a millionaire. So, you know, my wife makes everybody's beds with those statistics. But you know, the bad habits, me bad habits are basically distraction, constantly being distracted and not taking quiet time to meditate on things that are really genuinely important to you and just being in a rush continually. The bad we habits are being selfish, being unempathetic. The worst habit in the do category is debt. A debt is absolutely crushing to financial stability. And of course, as you've just learned with this wonderful transformation, you know, taking care of our health, you know, really it comes down to math. It comes down to calories.
Yeah.
It's not complicated, but people want to make it complicated, like there's a magic pill. And then going through life in the B cornerstone, going through life without set goals, without having a vision of what you want.
Yeah, it's a fascinating book, and I know you have to go in a couple minutes. I just had a couple more questions. How can we begin to define what success means to us personally? Like, people may not even think about that, but Where do you begin?
Well, you know, success looks like different things depending on where you, what stage you are in life. But I mean, when I was a little kid, success looked like being a rock star. And, you know, as I grew up, success was getting a college degree, and success meant making money and financial stability. And today, success looks like, you know, helping others. I just love going and volunteering and writing books and speaking about concepts that are authentic, that will really bring stability to people's lives and businesses. I love that. That's my meaning of success right now in this phase of my life. So in being the author of this book, I respect the reader that, you know, success doesn't always mean money. It means so many different things. I've got a good friend. His idea of success is beating cancer. So we got to define success, but then I come back to the common denominators that affect us all.
Yeah, and you know, in reading the book, it was really interesting because you were consulted on the World Trade Center, the Flight 93 crash site, the BP oil spill, Hurricane Katrina, as well as JonBenet Ramsey and O.J. Simpson. What was your expertise? I mean, why were you their go-to person? You even said that you think you know who killed JonBenet.
Well, I think I do, but I'll never say because it can't be proven in court, and I don't want to say something publicly and be wrong. But
right.
But the point is that I'm called in as an economist, but because I'm also a sociologist, I understand the patterns of behavior that led to the disaster. But more importantly, I know the patterns of behaviors that will lead us out of a disaster into resilience and that post-traumatic thriving I talk about. And so I get called in to calculate numbers and look at damages, but I learned a long time ago that it's more than numbers. You got to look at the people behind the statistics and their behaviors.
Now, when you looked at the OJ stuff, what did you see?
Well, you know, we all know the OJ case inside and out. It's been, you know, and I was involved with that with Lou Brown from the beginning, and then I got to know the family, and we're friends to this day, and I have utter respect for each and every one of them, how they've handled that tragedy in their lives with a lot of dignity. But I'll tell you, the one thing that came out of the O.J. Simpson case, I think I write about it in the book, was I was having lunch with Denise Brown, the sister of Nicole Brown Simpson, and I had heard something about O.J. on the news, and of course it was negative. He'd done something stupid. And I said, Denise, I heard O.J., blah, blah, blah. And she said, Randall, just keep it positive. And that really hit me because think about it.
Yeah.
Her sister was brutally murdered, and she had every right to be in an absolute rage for the rest of her life, and she made a conscientious choice to just keep it positive and just really, you know, enjoy life. And when you have the option of going to a bad, negative place, choosing another option and going to a good, positive place, I've kept that lesson through for the decades since that happened.
Yeah, I remember asking a shrink once, about depression, and she said, there's only one thing that's different between depressed people and people who are not depressed. And I'm like, what is that? And she said, it's the thoughts, thinking the thoughts. That's they think different thoughts. And so, you know, she was right on target with that. Today, my conversation was with Dr. Randall Bell. He's the author of the book, Rich Habits, Rich Life, The Four Cornerstones of All Great Pursuits. Thank you so much for talking to me today. Can people reach out to you? Do you have a website or social media or something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Just go to richhabits.com. The book is on amazon.com. And I love getting emails and texts, and I love hearing from people.
It was great talking to you. I'll have all the links to purchase the book after the interview airs. It'll be up on the podcast. Thank you so much for listening to me or talking to me today.
Oh, anytime, Kim. It was terrific.
You have a great one.
You too.
Take care. Bye. You've been listening to Conversations with Kim. Reach out to me, Kim Carson, via social media. On Instagram and YouTube, Kim Carson Now. I'm also on Facebook and Twitter, Kim Carson. Listen to my radio show middays on WLAV.com. And each Wednesday, I join the Hot Topics chat segment, 9 a.m. Eastern Time on ABC's Take 5 and Company on WZZM13.com. Listen to more episodes at kimcarson.podomatic.com. Until we meet again, thanks for listening to my podcast, Conversations with Kim.